Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on the Sydney Opera House with our speaker, Helen Pitt, who will be well known to many of you, but I'll introduce her briefly. As a Sydney Morning Herald journalist who has worked as the opinion and letters editor at Australia's oldest daily metropolitan newspaper, the Sydney Morning Herald, since she began her career there in 1986. She's also worked as a writer for the Bulletin magazine in California for the New York Times Digital and as a television reporter at Euronews in France. But Helen Pitt is here tonight on the occasion of the publication of her first book, The House, and the topic for tonight's discussion is the Sydney Opera House, its history and its people. Helen Pitt, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Jared. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I guess we'll start at the very beginning. I was driving across the Golden Gate Bridge a decade ago, listening to the BBC World Service on the car radio when I heard that the Danish architect Jørn Utzon had died. So like so many Sydney-siders the world over, I felt an instant stab in my heart. Those of us born in Generation Jørn all knew the great gift he gave our city, the Sydney Opera House, one of the indisputable masterpieces of human creativity, as UNESCO called it. So I'd lived in San Francisco for nearly a decade by then, but I was overcome by this wave of grief, of nostalgia for the city of my birth. So as I drove across the Golden Gate, I glanced to the right, just as you would as if you were driving across the Harbour Bridge. And I had this sort of instant transportation back to here. October 20, 1973. I was an eight-year-old girl on the windy spring day that Queen Elizabeth II opened our nation's most famous building. I'm not one of those three girls, just so you know. I was with my family on an especially chartered ferry, perched on the prime position on the harbour to catch the glimpse of our newly completed Sydney Opera House. We were typical Sydneysiders, waiting to see the opening of our much-talked-about building. There were roughly a million of us, according to police estimates. I remember admiring the giant, big, pink, red ribbons hanging from the Opera House shelves, as you can see them there. They billowed in the blustery wind, the white tiles of the sails glistened like a reptile, and I remember the Aboriginal actor Ben Blakely atop the big white sail proclaiming, "I'm Bennelong, the spirit of my people lives." So decades after the ribbons were cut, his words had a resonance for me as I little understood as an eight-year-old. Listening to his obit on the radio that day made me wonder, I wonder how much the media played a role in his downfall. So a bit like an archaeologist, I went on a dig into the past to find out. And in doing so, I discovered there were many more tragedies than just Utzon's behind the triumphant white sails on Bennelong Point. So let me take you back to Sydney, 1954. February 3, to be precise, it's the day that the Queen arrives in the Heads on the steamship Gothic. There are a million Sydneysiders perched all around the harbour. That's more than half the city's 1.8 million population. Here's the Queen in Martin Place, where she's laying a wreath at the cenotaph. And Sydney was awash with Union Jacks and these sorts of boomerang-shaped plywood-made banners with the little crown perched on top. Now, they were made by Ralph Simmons, who you may not have known, may not have ever heard his name. It's likely you would have if Utzon's plans with the Sydney Opera House would have gone ahead. So his plywood palace was on the Parramatta River, and he was renowned at the time for producing the world's longest plywood rolls that were up to 15 metres in length. So he's one of the many tragic figures, so just watch for his curves throughout the story. In the same year as the Queen's visit in Sydney, November, It was awash with a sea of jacarandas, and the first meeting took place to decide what and where we're going to place this cultural institution that's going to be like the Sydney Opera House. So the meeting was held in the lecture hall of the public Sydney Public Library in the Queen Victoria Building. Nugget Coombs spoke on behalf of the Elizabethan Theatre Trust, which had just been formed that year. He convinced the Menzies government to form it. And he said, "I'm certain, Premier Joe Carl, if you succeed, your name will live forever for the next 400 years as the head of government who put the Opera House there." Well, instead, his name lives in the form of the Carl Expressway that visually garrots Circular Quay. However, Ben Longpoint was his baby. And at the point, it was the turnaround for the city's trams, and it was the most likely place that was touted as the most likely location. The meeting was the culmination of 7 years of tireless campaigning on behalf of the Sydney Symphony conductor, Eugene Goossens, this man. He was the mastermind of the Sydney Opera House. He'd been lobbying his boss, Charles Moses, who was the general manager of the ABC, and they administered the nation's 6 state-run symphonies. He wanted a better building than the Sydney Town Hall for his orchestra to perform in. He'd vowed to make his fledgling Sydney Symphony members as famous as Australia's cricket stars. Instead, what happened is Goossen became infamous in Sydney when he became embroiled in Australia's most dramatic pornography scandal in 1956. It involved sex, black magic, Rosaline Norton, the witch of known as the Witch of King's Cross. I call it the 50 Shades of Eugene chapter in my book. It's probably best read in the privacy of your own home than detailed here. But he was the first casualty of the Opera House saga. Before he left, the conductor, who was also a steam train and cruise liner enthusiast, asked Bill Constable, an artist, to sketch a preliminary idea for a building at Bennelong Point. He had been living in America before being offered the job as the Sydney Symphony chief, and he'd been offered the job as head of the conservatorium as well, on a salary that was greater than the Prime Minister at the time, Ben Chifley. So he was quite a celebrity. And so his idea included the rounded piano windows and an outdoor amphitheatre, which is pretty much along the lines of the Hollywood Bowl, which he wanted to dominate, the symphony to dominate the space. But instead, the Carl government announced an international design competition with a prize money of £5,000. Then appointed a four-judge panel to choose a winner. Finnish-born American architect Eero Saarinen, who's pictured here, had been on the cover of Time magazine in 1956, the year the judges were appointed. He's the man who is pretty much responsible for choosing the design from the pile of rejects at the Australian at the Art Gallery of New South Wales. So here he is with his Gateway Arch model in St. Louis, Missouri, which he won the design competition for himself. He was the son of Finland's most famous architect, Eliel Saarinen, who got second place to Walter Burley Griffin in the design competition for Canberra. He grew up beneath the rounded domes of cupolas like this in his family's Helsinki villa and was a fan of this form of architecture. So he was working on the design for the TWA Flight Centre at Idlewild, known as New York's JFK Airport now, when he was asked to be one of the judges for the Sydney Opera House design competition. He'd met Jorn Utzon when Utzon was on a study tour to the United States on his way to study Mayan temples in Mexico, which later formed the inspiration for the podium for his masterpiece. So the two Scandinavians were friends, it's important to know. You can see here, perhaps, in his design for what is now being turned into a high-end hotel, why it was called the Grand Central of the Jet Age, and maybe some similarities to the Sydney Opera House. Saarinen, who arrived 4 days late for the judging, retrieved entrant number 218 from the pile of rejects. You might also see some similarities between it and the winning design, entry number 233 one of the designs of the 233 that arrived from all over the world. Initially, the winning design included gold leaf, under the white curves of the building that became synonymous with Bennelong Point, but that idea was dropped. It was a little too expensive. And this is just what it looked like on the days after the winning design was announced at the Art Gallery of New South Wales on January 29, 1957. The judges chose a relatively unknown 38-year-old Danish architect. Jørn Utzon was how Premier Joe Carl explained his name should be pronounced, Y-A-W-N, at the unveiling of the winner. At that point, his proudest accomplishment was the design of his own house in Hellebæk in Denmark, which is just north of Helsingør, which is famous for the Kronborg Castle. Many you might know from was the setting of Shakespeare's Macbeth. So Utzon built this yellow brick home, the south-facing home, without any plans whatsoever, other than paying attention to the laws of nature. You see from above, it's got an inner courtyard, a Chinese-style courtyard, and ceiling-to-floor windows on the inside. It was the first open-plan building in Denmark, open-plan home in Denmark, and it was modelled on the lines of Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture, because he'd met him also in America. So the judges said the drawings were simple to the point of being diagrammatic. So one judge, Sydney University's Harry Ingham Ashworth, commissioned his fellow university professor to render it in watercolour. He thought it might be a bit more convincing for the press and the public to show what his actual idea looked like. So here you see it in its original shape. It was a little sleeker, but engineering issues forced its shape to be changed. The runners-up came from America and England, so these are what we could have got if Utzon hadn't won. You'll see the one to the bottom underneath on the left had a helicopter pad. That was going to be, again, the jet age, the space age of Sydney, which might have been not such a bad idea. And another entrant from the Sydney Morning Herald illustrator, George Molnar, who was also an architect, was in the shape of a manly ferry. So there were many rejects that would have been really interesting to see what the shape of Sydney would have been like. It took several months from January to July 1957 for Joe Carl to convince his caucus of the benefits of the design. So, in fact, many, including the ABC boss, Charles Moses, thought there is no way this is going to get through the ALP. There's no way they are going to pay for such a bold building. So a motion to scuttle it was avoided when Carl decided to take the proposal to the ALP State Conference in 1957. So it was at the town hall, and a young immigrant woman who was from the clothing trades union, Miss N. Napper, that's all we know her name as, stood up and convinced the blokey blokes of the ALP that it was an important thing, that the Opera House wasn't just for hoity-toity people, as the blokes of the ALP called them. It was going to be something that would be of benefit for all young Australians and women especially. So miraculously, she got a standing ovation and convinced the ALP to go ahead with the idea. So the Opera House was going to be built thanks to her. Utzon came to Sydney for the first time in 1957. Here he is with his business partner, Eric Anderson, who was a Swede that came out with him initially to be a partner. He actually dropped out because he didn't like Sydney very much on his first visit. So here he is with Sydney Lord Mayor Harry Jensen, who's also known as Handsome Harry or Headline Harry by the press at the time. And the model was the one that they brought with them, of the first model of the Sydney Opera House. And it was to launch the public campaign, and it was also to launch the notorious party called the Kissing Party, which is a fundraiser. It's another racy chapter in this book that you really must read, because it's quite surprising how much the people of Sydney and their politicians wanted it. So the Opera House Executive Committee was formed. The man here on the left is known as Silent Stan Haviland. So he was the man who headed it. Premier Joe Carl kicked off the building in a ceremony in March 1959 at Bennelong Point. Again, Park Carl called it his baby, while everyone else called it the Taj Kahal. As he leant down to kiss the plaque made in the Danish shipyard Utzon and his wife brought from Denmark, the police band struck up the My Fair Lady hit with a little bit of luck, and the pneumatic drills began in the background. Civil and Civic, run by Dick Dusseldorf of Lend-Lease fame, was responsible for stage one of the building, the podium. Within 6 months, Carl tragically would die of a heart attack, the second public figure to disappear in the project. The first Sydney Opera House lottery was drawn in January 1958 because the Carl government decided it would pay for the building with lotteries, making it Australia's first crowd-funded building. So maybe that is one of the reasons we love it so much, because we all feel we own a little bit of it because we bought so many lottery tickets. All told, 469 lotteries raised the bulk of funds for the total cost of the building, which was $102 million. It would set the scene for perhaps the best-known tragedy associated with the building, the Graham Thorne kidnapping and murder. In 1960, Bondi's Basil Thorne, his smiling face, brandished the afternoon tabloids after he won the Sydney Opera House lottery. His son was kidnapped and killed on his way to school at Scots College. It was the first kidnap and ransom case in Australia, and it was also the first time forensic medicine was used to track a killer. When scientists used DNA testing to match the dog hair found on the Onkaparinga blanket that Graham's body was buried in at Clontarf. Thereafter, not for publication was an item to tick on every Sydney Opera House lottery ticket. So the 30-member Opera House committee was appointed as the client to architect Jornaldsen. Here's Ron Thompson, the secretary of the committee, examining the blueprints to the building. In hindsight, the committee as client was probably a bad idea. Utzon worked closely with them from the beginning, but you can imagine design by committee is cumbersome. It may explain why the costs got out of control very quickly. The initial estimate was £3.5 million for the building. Not Utzon's estimates, I might add, a government estimate. They usually bowed to Utzon's ideas, this committee, so they got on quite well. But as the government architect, Ted Farmer, would later say, it probably would have been better if the government architect's office had been put in charge instead of a hodgepodge of Sydneysiders. Utzon's father was one of Scandinavia's best-known boat builders. He was a naval architect in the northern Danish city of Aalborg who designed what became internationally renowned in sea scouting circles as the Aalborg dinghy. So Utzon used many methods in boat and ship construction for the building of the Opera House, and you can see them quite clearly here. So you see the workers using Ralph Simmons plywood to construct the wooden moulds for the more than 2,000 concrete segments that make up the building. They were glued together with an epoxy resin, a sort of super glue that had the consistency of condensed milk. It's the first time such a technique was used in a building of this size. And you can see here why the interior of the main hall kind of looked a little like inside an upended Viking boat. Over 10,000 workers from 90 different countries took part in the construction of this building. I interviewed quite a few of them because I could see that time was running out for them, and a lot of them died in the process of the 2 years it took for me to write this. So the crucial component to help construct the shells was the movable erection arch, which you can see here. It's a bridge building technique which was devised by the Stage 2 builders. That was Queensland construction firm Hornibrooks. It was designed by a gentleman by the name of Joe Bertone, who was a French spy who escaped two concentration camps and was given an award for valour from French President Charles de Gaulle for his wartime activities. He's still alive, 96, and living in Hornsby today, and was at my book launch on Monday. He's a remarkable man. Now, here's the Queen's cousin, the Earl of Dalkeith, and New South Wales Premier Bob Heffron, who took over after Carl's death, and they're at the 1959 opening of Ralph Simmons Plywood Factory at Mortdale. It's now known as Breakfast Point, near the Olympic Stadium at Homebush. Simmons was a maverick entrepreneur who zoomed around his plywood palace in a Dodgem-style device and was quite an interesting character. He went to visit Utzon in Denmark not long after his Opera House design win was announced to sell his products to the Dane. So Utzon was very impressed. as he preferred the European craft method of dealing with the craftsmen rather than the tender process, which is in more Anglo-Saxon nations, he struck up a deal with them initially, which didn't impress the government to begin with, but he had to put in the tender process later. And also he worked this way with the Swedish tile firm, Höganäs, which was developing what was called the Sydney tile, the more than 1 million tiles that make up the exterior of the building. So Utzon continued. The other major tragedy that occurred was that Ralph Simmons' lifeless body was found floating face down in pit water after a boating accident in 1960. So Utzon continued to work with his company, however, despite it going into receivership. Just as he's worked with the Swedish team, he again just wanted his fine craftsmanship. So above here we have the Plywood Palace that Ralph Simmons created on the banks of Parramatta River, which was built obviously with his own plywood. And it's been used variously as a government storage shed for various things, most recently WestConnex. Much like the Right Rail today, the building of the Opera House, although enshrined in ALP policy, became a political hot potato. The Askin government won the 1965 election by a slim majority of two seats, largely because the Opera House was taking so long and costing so much. And country people were really unhappy. So to appease them, William Davis Hughes, who was a Country Party member, was appointed as Public Works Minister. This is him here. He kneecapped the executive committee and put himself in charge of work and costs because they had completely spiralled out of control. Essentially, he became Utzon's paymaster. And a falling out between Utzon and Ove Arup, the Danish-British engineer in charge, was the result of a dispute over the use of the plywood mullions, that are these things that stand between the window panes here. And so the joints in the huge glass windows. That and the fact Hughes had stopped paying Utzon until he submitted plans and a complete date were the cause of the conflict. Utzon had wanted to use Ralph Simmons' plywood, just as it's seen here in the construction at the Dubbo Civic Centre. He called this a sisu roof. So sisu is a Finnish word that means to pull something out of yourself you didn't think that was possible, so sort of guts and determination. So he set up his loyal lieutenant, fellow Dane, Mogens Pipus, in an office in Western Sydney to work on this at the Plywood Palace. It sort of resembled the interior of a Bedouin tent that he'd slept under on a five-week journey to Morocco in the 1940s. That's Utzon. And the plan was for the plywood parts to be assembled in Mortdale and then sent, floated down the Parramatta River on barges. So the idea was a sort of conflation of Aida, the opera set on the banks of the Nile, about the building of the Cairo Opera House, and Handel's Water Music, which was performed on the banks of the Thames for King George I. So it was a very dramatic operatic idea that we never saw realised. It was Utzon's idea. My publisher at Allen & Unwin, Richard Walsh, calls this my Oscar and Lucinda chapter because it's a bit like the old glass things floating down the river there. So all plans for the plywood procession were halted due to the events in the Chief Secretary's building on February 28, 1966. So Utzon went to Davis's office as there'd been a standoff over the payments owed to him and the plywood mock-ups that he'd wanted to make at the factory. Utzon said, after a 15-minute angry interview, he was forced to leave by Davis Hughes. The Herald reported that he resigned angrily in interview. The details outlined in my book are one of the most dramatic chapters in the book and probably best read because it's complicated, but the day Ove Arup begged him not to go. He wrote a really heartfelt 7-page letter begging him not to go on April 27. The Dane left on April 28, the day after Ove arrived in Sydney. So this is how the Opera House looked when Jon Utzon departed. He left without meeting his friend, and they had a spectacular falling out. Again, another tragedy. The two only met again once by accident. They never talked again. And my book includes these letters and lots of things. I've spoken to lots of family members just to find out also how much of a tragedy it was, not just for Utzon, but for the Arup family, because this family said it stayed with him till his death at 90. Utzon always said he had the building in his head like a symphony, like a composer had a symphony, which was the problem for anyone taking over the project. Utzon's legal team, which included a young barrister by the name of Neville Rann and Clive Evatt, who was his friend Harry Sidler's father-in-law, handed over the plans to the government, or what plans they had. The trouble was they were not very detailed. So there are only these four fine craft models which loosely outlined what he had in mind, but there wasn't much to work with. Utzon started legal proceedings against the New South Wales government to get the money he was owed back. So the job fell to Ted Farmer, the government architect, to choose Utzon's successor. He chose one of the finest young architects in the country, Peter Hall, whose prodigious talent had won him scholarships to Cranbrook, to Wesley College at Sydney University, and a travelling bequest to Europe. He met his university sweetheart, Libby Hall, in London, and they went to Europe for their honeymoon. They were married there, and he met Utzon on their honeymoon because they went to stay in his Helvet property. It's quite a remarkable story. Again, I've got letters from the Hall family of him sending the letters home saying he was even offered a job by Utzon, but they declined because he was keen to get back to his job at the government architect's office where he'd worked as a trainee as part of his university scholarship. Now, while an international ban was called from architects on the building all around the world, eventually Hall took on the job of what was certainly the most unpopular job in architecture in its day. So as part of the interior designs, Hall was responsible for the windows, and he commissioned John Coburn to create the tapestry curtains of the Sun and Moon for the opera and drama halls, respectively. He's won the curtain of the Sun. The curtains were part of the building for the first year after it opened, but were taken down because they were considered too distracting. But a test hung took place earlier this year, and there are plans in the Opera House to bring them back. The Hall family were there, and they were incredibly moved. This is all part of the rapprochement to bring Peter Hall's narrative back into the story of the most Australia's most famous building. So against all odds, the consortium of Hall, Peter Hall, Lionel Todd, and David Littlemore, who is the Silk Stewart's father, completed the building amid much controversy. Tragically, Peter Hall received very little credit for his hard work. His marriage dissolved, and it was a point of shame for his children to tell people it was their father who completed Australia's best known building. His daughter, Becca, fled for London and never returned. Hall remarried, but they lost a child to cot death, and that marriage collapsed too. He went bankrupt many times. He became an alcoholic and was picked up on the streets by the Salvation Army more than once. In 1994, the Unseen Utzon exhibition was his undoing. He died of a stroke aged 64, yet another tragic figure in this Shakespearean-like tale. Utzon returned to Denmark but was shunned by his profession there. The Danish Architectural Association warned him he'd never work for the government there again because it looked like he'd walked away from the building in Sydney. He took private commissions at home and abroad, including this one from the Bagsværd Church in Copenhagen. The job, which he completed with his family, is said to be the interior that most resembles what his plans for the interior of the Sydney Opera House would have been like. So you can see that Sisu roof we talked about from the Dubbo Town Hall, and the lights, which if you've ever been in the Utzon room, come on and off when you stand. So Premier Bob Carr considers the rapprochement between the Utzon and the New South Wales government, which occurred in the early 2000s, the proudest accomplishment of his premiership. Utzon worked with his son Jan on the project and the Australian architect Richard Johnson, who's pictured here. But Utzon never came back to Sydney. The Utzon room and the toilets are among the additions he made to the building. I always thought the Danish designer who dreamt up the 20th century's most famous building, who never saw his masterpiece completed, was a tragic story. But you can see there are many more tragedies than just Utzon's behind the triumphant white sails on Bennelong Point. Today, though, it's a brand more recognised than Australia itself and has a total social asset value estimated in excess of $4.6 billion. A story that's equal part triumph and tragedy.
So many thanks to Helen Pitt, and she's finished precisely on time, so we've got plenty of time for questions and discussion. Now, we've got some copies today of The House by Helen Pitt, which has just come out, including a lot of, as was evident in your speech tonight, but also in the book, a lot of fresh information, a lot of personal letters revealed for the first time. So we've got copies at the end. I'm sure Anne's got them up there. I'm sure Helen would be happy to sign them. But now we go off to questions and discussion. Let's lead off with, it's probably a hard question, and I'm not an architect or an engineer or and have no knowledge in that area whatsoever, but the hard question is, I suppose, did Utzon leave because it was too hard? Did he leave because he couldn't finish it? And is a lot of the sympathy for him just a cover for the fact that he was in out of his depth and people had to help him out?
Jared, that's a question that everybody asks. And to be honest, I don't answer that in the book, but I do give a lot of indicators as to what other people thought. Many people thought he didn't have it in him. He was certainly getting frustrated. Important thing to know is Jørn Utzon was dyslexic and he never actually wrote down lots of things. He didn't read very much. So that was very frustrating for a lot of people that worked with him because they didn't really understand the way he worked. However, anyone that did work with him will completely tell you what a genius the man was in a way that's only like Einstein, because he really did have the idea in his head and he could draw it and sketch it very quickly, but he didn't necessarily leave very many plans like that. So it's questionable, and I don't even... I believe he could have. I don't know if it could have been in the time frame that would have been the right sort of time frame for the Askin government. And I think there's so many things that point towards him knowing what he was doing, because he was working all along with other people in the background, but it was just never very well documented. And this was problematic and partly his fault. He after the falling out with Arup, they bricked up the offices on site at Bennelong, so they no longer cooperated with each other. And then he moved up to Pittwater and in a boat shed and worked from there, and with an office with no phone. I mean, you can imagine how frustrating that was for people down at Bennelong Point trying to. So there's always that European versus Australian way of operating that may have been a contributor to the downfall. And just kind of completely understanding the way the man operated, was there weren't very many people who got that insider knowledge. And the ones that I did speak to said he certainly could have completed it. But if he did, it was a sheer bloody-mindedness that he didn't leave those plans. He left what he said he had, and certainly what his legal team said was all in existence. But I don't believe... He didn't know what he was doing. I don't think he was out of his depth. I mean, he could have been out of his depth from the very beginning, because the other thing is, he was the one that came up with the idea to solve the engineering issues of the building, because he came up after, despite thousands of man hours of work by Arabs in London that couldn't come up with a solution as to how to build the building. He came up with the idea himself. So that's known as the spherical solution, and apocryphally it's a story relating to an orange. It's not actually true. That's not how he came across the idea. He was at home putting some models away in Hellebeck and reaching in and putting them in, and he was putting them away and realising, I need to make a shape that can be repeated, geometric shape, because he was initially going to have like 2 or 3 inch thick concrete to the shells, but that was not working. So he did come up with that solution himself, and then went and tested the idea of the sphere by dipping his son's beach ball into the bath water and realising that he could cut out bits of spheres all through the building. And so I do believe he was very smart and a great problem solver. It just was that I think he wasn't working in the time frame that was appropriate for the New South Wales government. Did that matter? Not really, given that we were all paying for it, and it wasn't anything to do with the New South Wales government, really, because we were paying for it. It wasn't coming out of their revenue at all. But you know New South Wales politics, it's all about spin.
Okay, so there's a question here.
Helen, congratulations on the book and getting to the end of a very long project for you, it must have seemed. My question follows on from the comment on the spherical solution. One of the features of your book is that Utzon's family have almost come to an understanding that it wasn't a eureka moment, and you wrote about that earlier this year. Did you get any sense in the discussions of the diversity of influences on the spherical solution? But others he was working with, other professionals, Arabs, etc., helped him get to that point in time?
Yeah, well, I did. Certainly the young architects in his office were working very closely with him on the idea. So they played around with it constantly. But there is the reason the apocryphal orange story kind of came about is it was Saarinen's, actually. So Eero Saarinen, as you saw with that TWA building, was also having his own problems building curves. And so his second wife was the architecture writer at the New York Times, came out to interview him and fell in love with him and ended up coming on staff for him. And they got married and she became his big PR machine. And she got him a front page story in Time magazine. And in that story in 1956, he explained the way he came up with the solution was to take his breakfast grapefruit and cut it up and worked out how the sphere could come together for him. So I believe he borrowed it very strongly, you know, very much from Saarinen, and it wasn't his. There wasn't another apocryphal story that his son handed him the orange and there's the eureka moment, but that's not true. All three children dispute that. It's got mixed up in the mythology because it's a really easy way to explain it, because he says it's a spherical solution, like when you take an orange and cut it. So I do believe he looked at lots of influences, but he was the one that came up with it ultimately.
So, Anne, Helen, just stay here.
Hi, Helen. I want to go back to Peter Hall because we've had Anne Watson.
Yes.
And I've seen the documentary on it.
Yes.
You kind of jumped over what Peter Hall did, but what Peter Hall did was as good as anything.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it does seem, as the way you've told it, that Utzon really didn't know how to finish it. That he could do the external structure and those marble sails and everything else, but you have to make a building accessible and practical. And we're still kind of trying to work out how to make the opera house accessible and practical. It's got major flaws still.
Absolutely.
So could you go over the Peter Hall story a bit more? And it seems incredible that a man that did put it together got such bad treatment. Why?
It is. Well, where to begin on that one? Any of you were alive in that time, you'd remember how dramatic the whole thing was. There was very high drama going on. And I think Sydney was pretty much divided like the state of origin. You know, you're either in the New South Wales camp or the Queensland camp. It was either the Utzon camp or the New South Wales government's camp. So Peter Hall came in, obviously no idea how to begin, and went on a world tour initially to meet Utzon. And he tried. He actually refused. He was the third architect that was asked. He actually tried to get out of it. He didn't want to do it. He actually signed the protest to bring Utzon back. And so he said to the government architect, I don't want to do it. But in the absence of anyone else, his father-in-law convinced him. His father-in-law was a man by the name of George Bryant, who my cousin John Pitt here knows very well. He was a civil engineer and a very fine one. And he kind of convinced him to do it because we need an Australian to finish the job. If no one is going to do it, someone's got to step in. And the important thing to remember is there was a protest movement to keep Utzon there, which went up to Macquarie Street just days after he'd been sacked. But there was also a protest by the BLF calling for an Australian architect to complete the job. So you need to remember there were just as many people wanting him gone as there were wanting Utzon to stay. So Peter Hall takes up this job as a very, very unpopular job. And goes on his worldwide tour, the number of architects swells to 25 because he needs help. You know, he's calling in people from all over the place. He called his best friend back from London to help him. He called in as many people as he could. And the glass wall problem, no one had done this in the world either. No one had put in glass to that sort of degree, many, many acres of glass. So he did the glass windows. He did the purple carpets of the Northern Foyer. He commissioned John Olson's beautiful Five Bells painting. He did all the interiors of all the halls, and then got caught up in an argument over the use of the main hall. Again, Utzon's mistake, because it was the main hall that was always going to be the opera and mixed-use building. And then suddenly the ABC finds, oh, hang on, there's not as many seats as we want, and we wanted to be the main user of the building. So they come in and commission an arts specialist from London, who flies in from London and says, OK, you're going to swap it now. The main hall is going to be the Symphony Hall, and the opera is going to be downgraded, which upset people terribly. And Hall inherited all these awful problems and handled them with great good grace, I might add. And anyone that worked for Peter, as you'll see in Anne's beautiful book, The Poison Chalice, will tell you that he was a really inspiring man to work with. The other thing, the workers on site really loved Peter Hall. They weren't so impressed with Jorn Utzon. They felt him as a bit imperious, a bit European, a bit away from them in their day-to-day dealings. And one of the lovely stories of Peter Hall's second wife at the test concert in 1972, that was, you know, the first thing to test it. All the workers came, and Peter Hall made sure all the workers came. And one of them came up to him and said, "You know, mate, I always thought you were a bit of a poof, but you're an all right bloke." You know, in those days, completely, you know, the sort of like highest compliment. But they loved him, and they really got on well. And anyone from Arabs will tell you that too, because it had got so difficult between the Utzon camp and Arab camp that nothing was going ahead. You know, there was no... For 2 years, work stopped on the building, because nothing was happening. However, interestingly, in the mid-60s, it was already Australia's most important tourist destination. So there was enormous interest in the story worldwide and here. So, like, Peter Hall did extraordinarily, I think, in hindsight. He did the Vermilion Wool. He did a very high 70s, all Australian products, got his own plywood suppliers, did everything. And I mean... my feeling is I love the interiors, and they're as much a part of the building as the exterior. I think the thing that I recognised in my two trips to Denmark was when I went to the Utzon Centre and sat beneath the Bedouin-like tent ceiling. It was all very white and Scandinavian, and it made me think, wow, how would this have sat in Sydney? Part of the thing that people love about the Opera House, I believe, is it's really Australian interiors, like the brush books, timber, the colours, the things that reflect Australia of that era. Even the Bennelong restaurant, you know, it was going to be completely different under Utzon, but there was also a cinema, if those of you might remember, in the early days. So there was a whole load of things that Peter Hall brought to the building that I don't think we discredit. Now, I mean, I think with the distance, benefit of hindsight, many of us realise the things that Peter Hall put in are the things we love as much as the outside. So, I mean, he's a character that is deserving of a place in Australian history. And the Opera House CEO, Louise Herron, is really trying to make that a legacy of her time. So I really hope you go away from here tonight remembering the name Peter Hall and the great contribution he gave to the Sydney Opera House.
Helen, thank you for bringing the Opera House to us so clearly, and it made us so excited about it. I'm wondering if I could ask you if there is a contemporary challenge to everybody who lives in Sydney or New South Wales that we might address. And bring a lottery to change some significant part of Sydney. I have in mind, if you walk outside the Sydney Town Hall, down the steps, you're confronted with the ex-head office of Woolworths, and you can't see anything else. We need a plaza, and we need a lottery. But I'd love your comments.
Don't you think we should try and lobby Gladys for that possibly. I agree, a town square would be just the beating heart of Sydney. I completely agree. I mean, that's the thing. This is Sydney Opera House is Sydney's greatest urban story, I believe. It's an urban story. And if anything, it should inspire us to think about the spaces that we live in. In fact, when it was approved in that 1954 building, the parks and playground people were deeply upset because they lost a lot of outdoor space. But, you know, it's definitely something that we should be thinking about, how we keep our city as vibrant and beautiful. I'm all for that. Let's start lobbying Gladys, I'd say.
Do you think it would have been built today because there might have been an environmental campaign to keep the old tram sheds. They should be preserved. And Jack Mundy might have been out there putting on a green band to preserve the tram sheds.
It's a very good point, Jared. I completely agree. I don't think it would have been built today. It was very bold for its time. And, you know, Jack Mundy did stop the building of the car park. The first green ban at the Opera House took place when the car park was going to be initially just under the Botanic Gardens, and those Moreton Bay figs were going to be knocked down. And eventually that held up the building. The car park took one of the longest things to complete. It wasn't completed till many years after the building opened. And it's, you know, this swervy corkscrew thing that's known as the donut for divas now, because you go all the way down, like the donuts descending in the symphony. I truly don't think it would have been built, because we're a lot more cautious about what we do with public space. And it was such a radical design. I mean, can you imagine if you saw that yourself on the front page of the Herald and thought, what? And I really think it probably wouldn't have. But, you know, all praise to the people that were bold enough to do it, because I love it. I'm assuming most of you in the room do too.
Thank you.
No. We're going here.
Sorry.
Speak into the microphone.
The one thing I love about the Opera House is when I first went there, I knew my mother-in-law bought a lottery ticket every week, so I could sit there in that Opera House and know she contributed a lot of money to that.
I think we all did. I think that's why Sydneysiders love it so much. You know, the ubiquitous rice paper thin lottery ticket was as much a part of Sydney and Sydney Christmases and birthdays as the jade plant by the door that was placed there to bring you good luck to win it. So it is definitely, I think, as I said, the crowd-funded building, and I really think a lot of us feel we own it because we contributed a lot of money towards it.
There's a question there.
Elsa Atkin is my name.
You've got to speak into the microphone.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I was Elsa Kamara when I worked for Utzon as his PA.
Mm-hmm.
I actually typed the letter of his resignation
on
the 28th of February 1966. You can see that my voice is...
Oh, yeah.
Because it was a very, very emotional time. I just wanted to comment on something. I can't really comment on a lot of things you said.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's fantastic that you gave the story full on from the beginning, rather than just the Opera House itself. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to say to you, it's not that difficult to explain why, apart from the fact that we were so loyal to Christian when we worked for him, why it was so difficult for other architects to accept to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, because Utzon resigned because he did not have any money to pay his staff.
Yes, he was being...
That was the most important thing. They were all young people. I think the age was probably the only man who was there who was in his 40s was Bill Whitland.
Yes.
Who was at the manor. Mm. The rest were all young, enthusiastic, creative architects that needed to be paid. Much as they loved Utzon,
yes,
they didn't receive any money.
And he was bankrupt.
That's one.
No, but we've got to be brief, okay?
The second thing I just wanted to say is about creativity. You said people didn't want to do the work that Utzon left behind. You know, because if you are painting a painting and you do half of it, would someone else come and paint the second half of it?
Well, that is the challenge of the building, isn't it? Yeah.
You don't, as a creative man,
we can't pick all this up in the podcast.
Creation.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. It's like an incomplete Rembrandt, isn't it? So it was very hard to complete.
But someone did complete it. I mean, that's...
It had to be completed. It was a public building.
Mm. Mm. Oh, well, actually, Utzon would have been happy at one point, he said, to have it left as like an outdoor concert area like Meyer Music Bowl. But, you know, that was not ever going to happen. And I don't think we would have accepted that, and rightly so. But, yeah, it was... There was a standoff for 2 years and a lot of political campaigning went on. But how wonderful to meet the woman that typed the letter. I mean, it's must have been extraordinarily hard. I understood that he did it many, many times. Yeah, and agonised over it.
And his language wasn't the best.
That's so right.
We had to do a lot of corrections.
Yeah.
Okay, Michael? Now we'll just wait for Maya. As we're getting the microphone around to Michael, I think Michael appears on page 294 of the book. Is that right?
Oh, you do too. Yeah.
Thanks. Funnily enough, the page I'm looking at is page 261, where you say... Despite Arabs declining all opportunities to speak with the press in Sydney, Utzon still felt betrayed, especially by Michael Lewis, who was the local Arab representative, especially by Michael Lewis and his friend of Arab, who had presented themselves to the government as being in charge of the project. Mm. Now, the question I want to raise with you is, as I understand it, and I think I outlined that in my book of 40 years ago.
Yes, yes.
They were, in fact, in charge of the project because the government did not allot the contract to Utzon. They allotted the contract to the engineer,
yes,
which presumably was the poison chalice that eventually killed Utzon's role.
Precisely. That's right, Michael. And Michael obviously knows this because he did write a beautiful book 40 years ago. Not only that, there were so many errors in the way it was set up, that initial things, that the executive committee, the client, Arabs being in charge, it really did back everyone into a corner. And then the act, the Opera House Act, that made the Public Works Minister in charge, and Ted Farmer said, look, in hindsight, we should have been the ones in charge of the building. It would have been much easier to deal with. So I completely agree. The whole kind of... there were too many cooks... They spoiled the broth in a way. I just think there were too many people involved in the whole...
The point of my question is surely Utzon was deluded because legally he was not in charge pretended he was.
Mm. Well, I think he felt that he was, and he always was able to get his way, obviously, with the executive committee because they worked so closely together. But, yes, when it came to the absolutely crucial time, Arabs were in charge and they did step away from Utzon and stopped supporting him. So, yeah, it was just... That, in fact, I think is the biggest tragedy of the story, that the Arab-Utzon split, because it's heartbreaking. And you can tell in the letters, handwritten letters, how much it broke both their hearts, I think.
Now, you were saying earlier that everyone owned the opera house, in a sense, but that's not quite true, is it? Because I would start with... Sydney Anglicans wouldn't have been in this because they wouldn't buy a lottery ticket.
I think I know a few Anglicans that did, but anyway. It's a bit like bootlegging, isn't it?
So the people who built the Opera House were the people who were into gambling, right?
Yeah, well, as you know, we are the biggest... Yes, we're the largest number of gamblers in the country, but I do think most of us, if we didn't buy one, certainly received one as a gift. But yes, you're right. I don't know if there were too many Sydney Anglicans that said no. I don't know. Is there any in the room that said no to buying a lottery ticket? I'm not really sure.
You can send the office boy to get...
there were always waves around.
So the comment was you can send the office boy to get it, that'd be okay. All right, now, where do I go next? I'm trying to keep this serious, you know. Yes, Anne?
I just want to go back to the whole point about this deal. I mean... We're talking as if Utzon was allowed to come over to Australia because he's such a genius and design a building that has been an icon of Australia for many decades. But if he couldn't manage his business and if he couldn't manage to get on with the people who are in charge of constructing it, and it's a public building for New South Wales, no surprise. He spat the dummy and he went. And it's always seemed to me this sort of sacred Utzon mentality is unbelievable. If you're in business anywhere in the world, no matter how much of a genius you are or whatever, there are certain limitations to what you're able to do in any contractual agreement.
Mm.
And he just thought, and the idea that he just leave it all as a ruin to his great name is just unbelievable self-indulgence.
Absolutely, and as Michael mentioned, Michael Lewis, the man on site for Arabs, said as much. He said, like, you've all fallen under the spell of Jorn Utzon. You know, I haven't. What is it that makes you think that? But, like, he was a very, very beautiful man. But, I mean, anyone that worked for him clearly had extraordinary things to say about how inspiring he was. But, yes, they were completely different ways of behaving, you know, the European visionary versus the pragmatic politician in New South Wales. But, and we were a young, vibrant go-ahead nation at that time. It would never have been built in Europe, and that was the other thing too. He realised that. He knew that he was getting the chance of a lifetime. So in many ways he blew it because he didn't really... Why? I don't know. Did he not understand, or was he being the creative genius? I don't know. That's up to contention. And I mean, I know that my dealings in Denmark showed me that, you know, he was a very different man, you know, a very different way of thinking to 1957 Sydney, and then continuing on to 1960 Sydney. It might have been completely different now. We would have had different expectations of what the expectations of his role would have been way more clear, I believe. But that is the tragedy. You know, it's not as simple as the great Jorn genius and misunderstanding how Australia operated. There were so many layers in this complex tragedy. I don't think there's one simple solution other than the fact that it's really a miracle that the building got off the drawing board and was completed in the first place.
As a final question, tell us a bit about yourself, because you would expect that someone with your background at the Sydney Morning Herald and journalism would know how to handle all the government and the politics and the human relationships. But you're also obviously quite on top of some of the engineering, which is not an ability that many of us would have. So how did you handle that part of the technical side of the book?
Yeah, that was the hard part. My father was an engineer, and I guess it's a homage to him, and my mother was a pianist. So there was a combination of... she loved to play the piano and he loved to look at the building and say, how did they build that? So chapter 18, the building of in the book, is very much the one I worked the hardest at, because I really wanted to look at it the way my father would have looked at the building and say, how did they do that? I would look at things... I don't look at things like that. I look at, oh, it's beautiful, isn't it? How nice. So I guess I really tried to invoke the way my father would have looked at it. And he knew Ralph Simmons. He knew... the plywood palace. He built our home out of the plywood from Ralph Simmons' factory. So I guess I had personal interest in it because it was part of my childhood. So I guess I wanted to pin down the men that were the engineers. It's less an architecture book and more an engineering book, if we must say that, but it's actually a story about the people of Sydney, and that they were the people that I was really interested in interviewing and finding out the backstory of. So that's why I guess my personal reason is I wanted to kind of understand how it was put together. And I'd lived overseas for 16 years, and it was the building that everyone knew. It was the building that around the world was usually the only thing anyone ever knew about my hometown, Sydney. So I became a bit of an expert from when I was an exchange student in Sweden, talking about it, and in America when I lived. So I guess it became a bit of a passion project because I learnt about it because people asked me about it so much abroad. And then when I came back, I just thought, well, it's time to look at that Fairfax archive and see what's left. And I interviewed some of the original journalists that covered the story and the builders, the people that were around at the time. I was really concerned that the Fairfax archive might disappear, and that's why I did it. And also I found the Telegraph, that was owned by Frank Packer at the time, was the opposition newspaper at the time, in the Mirror, and no one could find the files in Murdoch, because Murdoch bought the Telegraph and the Mirror in 1972. So I didn't want... I mean, I know you can get all this stuff on Trove, but I didn't want that. I wanted the paper, newspaper clippings, because you could... The things that help you are the weather on the day and what year it was like, you know, who was flying into town on that day, and all those little details that help you create a story. So... I found them thanks to Richard Walsh, my publisher, who went looking for them at the ACP, which is now Bauer, found them in the bowels of Bower Building in two cardboard boxes with a whole load of photographs and that had would have gone missing. They never made it over to Holt Street, to Murdoch's premises. So I had access to these extraordinary photos and newspaper clipping files that were perhaps even more thorough because they hadn't been used, you could tell, since 1972. They hadn't been opened. They were still so neat. So that was another reason, I guess, from a professional level. Sorry?
Where are they today?
They're with Bower. They're in their library properly now. I borrowed them, but they were in my house for quite some time. But then they're back put in their rightful place in a properly filed file.
Many thanks, Sir Helen.
Thank you, Jerry.
Well, thanks to Helen, Petra, for a terrific presentation tonight. I mean, it's a very substantial achievement, this book, and a very important contribution, not only to the history of Sydney and New South Wales, but also to the history of Australia, because this is an Australian building above all, and that's how it's recognised. So, as I said, we've got some copies of Helen Pitt's The House, published by Allen & Unwin, available. I'm sure Helen would be happy to sign them. But today I'd just like to say, well done. Congratulations on tonight and good luck with the book. Well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.